Parliament Speaker says Israel's acts of aggression against Palestinians in the occupied territories reveal the regime's fascist and apartheid nature. North Korea's leader calls for strengthening of the country's war deterrence to cope with the escalating aggressive moves by the US and South Korea. Also ahead, the US Defense Department admits the recent leak of highly sensitive documents poses a very serious risk to the country's national security. Good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran's parliament speaker says escalating Israeli aggression against Palestinians is further evidence of the regime's fascist and apartheid nature. Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf says Israel is trying to cover up its own internal weaknesses and divisions by continuing crimes against Palestinians. He said these atrocities include the massacre of Palestinians as well as storming and desecrating holy sites. Iran's parliament speaker reiterated the country's principled policy of supporting the Palestinian cause. Qalibaf noted that the Iranian parliament regards resistance as the sole way to counter Israel's expansionism. He added that parliaments of Muslim states must shape their government's policies on Palestine. Qalibaf was virtually addressing the Palestine Committee of the Organization of Islamic Countries Parliamentary Union. The Iranian army's chief commander has brushed aside the Israeli military rhetoric, saying that the regime is too weak to be considered a threat. Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi was responding to the Israeli military chief of staff. Herzi Lavi had said that Israel is ready to attack Iran and can do so without the support of the United States. The Iranian army commander says such comments are aimed at boosting the morale of Israeli troops and addressing the regime's internal problems. The general warned against unwise measures by the leaders of the regime that is already on the brink of collapse. Israel has for years threatened Iran with military action over the country's nuclear program. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says Israel's military rhetoric against Iran is merely intended for domestic purposes.
I think this is just part of the Zionist saber rattling. We've been seeing it for well over a decade now. Especially under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. Iran is the big boogeyman in the region, and it's a way to use Iran and the threats, quote-unquote, that Iran poses towards the Zionist regime as a political capital for domestic consumption within Israeli society. So I do not see this as being serious. The only thing that, that really supports the Zionist regime is not only the U.S., but the fact that it has nuclear weapons. If it had neither support nor nuclear weapons, it would collapse tomorrow. But, of course, this is part of ongoing saber rattling. And I should mention that, of course, we've been seeing all the political upheavals within Israeli society. And so this is an opportunity to try to unite all the people around a common enemy. And that's what we're seeing now in Israel today.
Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in northern occupied West Bank, injuring over 200. The raid took place in Beita village near the city of Nablus. Israeli forces targeted Palestinians with tear gas and rubber-coated bullets. The Palestinians were protesting against a march by Israeli settlers to the nearby settlement outpost of Evyatar. The settlers were demanding the regime's legalization of the outpost. They were accompanied by seven Israeli ministers. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Tensions are running high across the occupied territories. Israeli forces and settlers have been carrying out raids at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, while Palestinians have been retaliating with rocket attacks from Gaza, as well as shooting and car ramming operations. Anthony Jelicek is an author and researcher. We asked him about the Israel's recurrent acts of violence against Palestinians and how the international community, particularly the West, is responding to them.
The Zionist regime cannot exist and cannot survive without this continuous barbaric violence that it is inflicting on the indigenous Palestinians, and which it also is inflicting beyond Palestine, in fact. So we see that every year, as you mentioned, for major significant holidays, these humiliations and attacks and torture and killing of people at the hands of settlers and the Zionist regime, again, as part of this very colonial conquest, because the Zionist regime cannot sustain itself without this continuous violence on which it was actually built. The Zionist colony emerged through tactics of terrorism and genocidal killings and expulsion of the indigenous people. So it is very much the essence of, I think, what Zionism represents. There is no way to ever rely on the so-called international community, in particular the West, even when there were some maybe slight moments of some sort of criticism from the West. None of this has ever led to any actual actions being taken against the Zionist regime. On the contrary, actually, the Zionist regime serves as a proxy for the United States, in many ways, as the European Union does as well. So, and we've seen again how Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian resistance are being condemned, and it's over and over again the same language used by the West and by the also the UN, which has a very imbalanced internal power relations.
Meanwhile, the Hamas resistance movement says Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu's threats will not weaken Palestinians' resolve to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque against the regime's religious war. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem says Netanyahu cannot intimidate the Palestinian people. He said Israeli occupation is the source of all tensions across the occupied territories. Qasem added that Netanyahu's threats against Palestinians, as well as Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, prove that the Israeli regime is a menace to the entire region and its interests. The Hamas official stressed that the Israeli regime is the one which has been systematically and continuously practicing terrorism. During a speech on Monday, Netanyahu accused Hamas of resorting to terrorism and trying to gain a foothold in southern Lebanon. Netanyahu said Israel will, in his words, act on all fronts to stop Hamas from establishing itself in Lebanon. Saudi and Omani delegations are in Yemen to hold talks with Ansarullah officials. The negotiations are aimed at bringing the years-long Saudi war in Yemen to an end. According to UN figures, the war has so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and displaced many more across the war-torn nation.
Years into the Saudi war on Yemen, there are hopes that the prolonged conflict may be coming to an end. Delegations from Saudi Arabia and Oman have arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to hold talks with leaders of the Ansarullah movement. Upon arrival, the delegations met with senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi. The delegations have also met with head of the council, Mahdi al-Mash'at. According to a diplomat, the Saudi delegation, headed by their ambassador to Yemen, Mohammed Said Al-Jaber, is in Sana'a to discuss moving forward to create peace in Yemen. Yemeni media say the Saudis are going to negotiate the removal of tied naval and air blockade on Yemen and an end to the 8-year-long aggression, restoration of the Yemeni nation's rights, and the payment of civil servants' salaries as well as portion of oil and gas revenues during negotiations. A Yemeni source said the Saudis and Houthis had agreed in principle on a 6-month truce to pave the way for talks on establishing a 2-year political transition for the war-torn nation. The presence of Saudi and Omani delegations in Yemen was hailed by the Ansarullah movement. Senior Ansarullah member Muhammad al-Bukhaiti said achieving an honorable peace between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia would be a triumph for both sides. Bukhaiti has urged all sides to take steps to preserve a peaceful atmosphere and prepare to turn the page of the past. Inside Yemen, people express hope that the negotiations would produce favorable results.
We hope for the best and we hope that these negotiations can lead people to safety.
The talks also drew positive reactions from the United Nations. UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, described the ongoing efforts, including the Saudi and Omani talks in Sana'a, as the closest Yemen has been to real progress towards lasting peace since the war began. He said this is a moment to be seized and built on, and a real opportunity to start an inclusive political process under UN auspices to sustainably end the conflict.
None of the stated goals of the years-long conflict in Yemen has been achieved. This has prompted the Saudi authorities to realize that the Western approach for Yemen is no longer working. Riyadh has recently reached the rapprochement with Tehran and is resuming official relations. It's also holding talks with Ansarullah leaders to end the war in Yemen. It seems that Riyadh is making a U-turn in its regional political approach.
The peace talks in Yemen come years after the Saudi government launched a devastating war on the Arab country, hoping it would win in less than a month. The aim of that war was to crush the Ansarullah movement and reinstate former Yemeni President Abdur Abu Mansur Hadi to power. Riyadh has used most sophisticated weapons purchased from the United States and the United Kingdom against the Yemeni people, along with a land, air, and sea blockade on the country. The conflict, however, has stopped well shy of its goals, despite turning the entire country into the scenes of what the United Nations termed as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. According to UN figures, hundreds of thousands of people have so far been killed and millions of others displaced. The war also destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure, leaving millions of people across the country in desperate need of vital necessities. The peace talks also come on the backdrop of a recent China-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to normalize relations. The negotiations aimed at bringing an end to the Yemen conflict are indications of a number of things. First and foremost, the talks show that the war has brought Saudis to an utter exhaustion. After all, putting all that fun and Western tactical support for Riyadh should get them somewhere. The war on Yemen did not. Secondly, the Saudis have come to realize that Western prescriptions for their war on Yemen is not working. On the contrary, they have come to the understanding that establishing regional peace lies in the reunification of nations in West Asia. Maybe that's why they decided to end hostilities with Tehran and normalize their relations with the Islamic Republic. All what it is, it seems that with Saudi authorities trying to distance themselves from the United States and its warmongering policies, the West Asia region can be a place where countries can coexist, having strong brotherly ties.
The North Korean leader has called for boosting the country's war deterrence with increasing speed and in a more practical and offensive manner. Kim Jong-un made the comments at a meeting of the Central Military Commission. The meeting reportedly discussed how to counter escalating U.S. and South Korean moves to unleash a war of aggression. Pyongyang has been reacting angrily to a recent series of joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises, which it says are rehearsals for an all-out war. In response, it has been carrying out various military activities. Those include unveiling new smaller nuclear warheads, testing a nuclear-capable underwater attack drone, and firing an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of striking anywhere in the United States. Moving on, the Pentagon says the leak of its classified files presents a very serious risk to U.S. national security. The U.S. Defense Department says the disclosures could even be deadly, putting the country's intelligence sources at risk. It voiced fear that the leaked documents could give the country's enemies valuable information. Scores of highly sensitive documents have been circulating on social media for months, but only began to receive media attention last week. The U.S. is now trying to remove them. The White House says it is concerned that there may be more documents to come. Many of the documents relate to the war in Ukraine, but others show Washington has been spying on its allies, including Kiev, Tel Aviv, and Seoul. U.S. media say the leaks have already complicated relations with U.S. allies. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of this series. Allah and the angels greet the Prophet constantly. Allah has also ordered the faithful to greet him. He says in Ayah 56 of Surah Ahzab, "Indeed, Allah and his angels bless the Prophet. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and invoke peace upon him in a worthy manner." In view of this, it has been highly emphasized to greet the Prophet and his progeny before praying. In other words, we are recommended to start prayers with praise of Allah and greeting the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt. According to the narrations, we are also recommended to finish prayers with greeting the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt. This is the way which makes the prayer be heard and accepted by God. It is quite logical and reasonable to love those who God loves. In Dua Iftitah, which is read in the nights of the blessed month of Ramadan, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, teaches us to greet the Prophet in this way. O Allah, bless Muhammad, your servant, your Prophet, and your trustworthy. In this part of the supplication, what is emphasized for the Prophet is the status of being the servant of Allah. In fact, this is the highest point of proximity with God. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in a brief but profound supplication to God, "It suffices as dignity for me to be your servant, and it suffices as honor for me that you are my Lord. You are just as I like, so make me just as you like." Servitude of God is so important that we should testify this in every daily ritual prayer when we say, "I testify that Muhammad is his servant and prophet." After mentioning the status of God's servant, we mention prophet as another status of Prophet Muhammad, and then we call him trustworthy. This means to remind us that he strove in the way of Allah so hard while he was trusted by God, and whatever he said was true. He conveyed the message of Allah fully without increasing or decreasing even a single word. It has been narrated that the Prophet said to the people in the last days of his life, "I set as halal whatever the Quran had made halal, and set as haram whatever the Quran has made haram." In other words, he meant that he was absolutely trustworthy in proclamation of God's mission and had not deviated from the right path. God tells us in Ayah 21 of Surah Ahzab, "Indeed, in the Prophet of Allah, there is a good exemplar for you." That is to say that we should follow the Prophet in our life. We say in Dua Iftitah, "O Allah, bless Muhammad, your servant, your Prophet, your trustworthy, your chosen, and your close friend." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the God's choice for his mission, and he loved him as a close friend. It is noteworthy that God tells the Prophet in Ayah 31 of Surah Ali Imran to tell the people, "Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you." God loves his prophets, particularly the last of them, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. So, the only way to draw God's love is to follow his beloved Prophet. In the end of this part of the supplication, we ask God to bless the Prophet, this kind of blessing, the highest, the best, the most beautiful, the most perfect, the purest, the most thriving, the most fragrant, the cleanest, the brightest, and the highest in the number of what you have greeted, blessed, have mercy, have had affection, and saluted any of your servants, messengers, prophets, chosen ones, and nobles from among your creation. In fact, we ask God to bestow on the Prophet the best of whatever he has bestowed on any of his creatures. Food for thought. Salam, friends, and condolences to you all on the fateful 19th of Ramadan, the day on which, while engrossed in the morning prayer in the Grand Mosque of Kufa in Iraq, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, was struck a fatal blow of a poisoned sword by the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam, and the expression that came to the lips of the mortally injured vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad as his fruitful 63-year life was about to end was, "By the Lord of the Kaaba, I have succeeded."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, fasting is a means of getting closer to God Almighty. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on Islamic Lifestyle. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm honored to have you as my listener. Today we're going to study about the meaning of fasting and to understand that fasting is a means of getting closer to God, to Allah the Almighty. So, talking about this issue, we should say that fasting is a means of getting closer to Allah because it kills the lust of the soul and strengthens the holy and spiritual powers of a person. It makes a person aware of the fear of the day of judgment and reminds him the thirst and hunger of that day. And accordingly, it frees a person from boredom and other corruptions. So if we remind the troubles we're going to face on the day of judgment, we can easily, by a little practicing, free ourselves from boredom, from corruptions, from disobedience and sins. But there is one point we should note, and that is when we fast in the Ramadan month, in the month of Ramadan, we must pay attention to the reasons for fasting, the reasons behind it. So we must study and reflect on the effects of fasting and the reasons for it. And only in this way can the spiritual qualities of fasting appear in our hearts. Otherwise, as Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam said, our fasting will be nothing but enduring hunger and thirst. For example, when we endure hunger and thirst, we should pay attention to the conditions drawn for us on the Day of Judgment. And by thinking about this issue and reminding it, free our soul, free our heart from the willing towards committing sins. And we should not let the month of Ramadan pass carelessly.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on Islamic Life and Style. I'm Farad, your host, and we have talked about the effects of fasting and its importance, and also understood that this is the way for spiritual effects to appear in our hearts. So, if someone can fast under this condition, I mean he's fasting, he's enduring thirst and hunger, while paying attention to the reasons behind this action, the promise of Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam will be fulfilled. And it's very great. But the condition is that we have to accompany our fasting with paying attention about the reasons and thinking around the reasons behind fasting. Otherwise, our fasting actually is nothing. We are fasting to remind ourselves the problems we are going to face on the Day of Judgment, in order to free ourselves, in order to strengthen our hearts, to stay against wailing towards committing sins. So, Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam has promised to a person that fasts under this condition something very great. He said, whoever fasts for God on a very hot day and becomes thirsty could compose 1,000 angels to come and anoint the face of the fasting person and bring him good news about heaven, until God says to him at the time of the breaking the fast, how good your smell and your soul have become. O my angels, bear witness that I have forgiven this my servant. So this promise will be fulfilled for the person who accompanies fasting by thinking about the reasons of fasting, and the most important one, refraining from prohibitions in this very, very great month. So I wish that we all are subjected to this noble hadith and staying away from prohibitions. Thank you for staying with us. Goodbye, and I hope everyone is doing well.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir. Our email is english@irib.ir.
But I know that you are really loving, you are really caring. I can't realize, but you know that I will be better, that I will be stronger if you are by my side. Allah.
In early April, the French president and the head of the European Commission flew into Beijing. Their joint trip was the latest in a push from European leaders to engage with China and persuade President Xi to take further steps to halt the Ukraine-Russia conflict, which has brought about an energy crisis with all its concomitant sufferings for Europe. If the war rages on, there is no guarantee of a good year ahead for the Europeans, as they're already struggling to keep the energy crisis at bay. There was a belief that Russia was heavily dependent on Western technologies to keep its oil and gas flowing, dependent on Western markets for its revenues, and on Western financial systems to facilitate its energy exports. It was hoped that if cut off from these, Moscow would face rapid economic collapse. No doubt the European oil and oil products embargo did result in higher costs for Russian operators, but they do not appear to have significantly damaged the Russian oil trade. Now, a year after the war, Russian oil production is also at pre-war levels. Despite the media hype, the European leaders know that the energy war they have been engaged in with Russia is still far from over. Currently, Europe faces a number of energy sector-related risks in 2023. These include a rapid recovery in Chinese economic demand, which would bring the country back into the global market for LNG and increase competition for global cargoes. With LNG global production likely to remain limited throughout the current year, LNG supplies will be reduced, and as a result, Western manufacturers might be facing tougher competition from Asia. The situation could be further compounded if another year of drought impacts hydroelectricity production.
These are also concerns over technical problems at France's aging nuclear power stations. If nuclear facilities are forced to undergo unplanned maintenance for an extensive period of time, Europe would be obliged to switch on its gas-fired generation, lifting demand for the fuel. Moscow might also try to recreate the 1973 energy crisis by withdrawing its oil from the markets. So far, though, it's been pragmatic and preferred to work around the embargoes. Against such a backdrop, Europe is trying to diversify its energy portfolio, but gigawatts of solar and wind power cannot be added overnight. Planning, funding, and building wind and solar farms is a multi-year process and cannot help Europe out in the immediate future. Diversification also means increasing gas flows through pipelines from Norway to North Africa, but even more notably, a dramatic increase in liquefied gas imports from countries such as the US or Qatar. But again, it might increase the risks of new dependencies from countries that could pose a geoeconomic risk to Europe in the future. While transitioning away from Russian energy is the EU's top priority, that will not be easy. Despite the fall in energy imports from Russia since the war, Russian energy still accounted for more than 40% of Europe's stored gas for last winter. The short-term story is therefore one of elevated prices and heightened volatility as countries scramble to identify alternative sources of gas, a cocktail of inflation and recession. Right now, headline inflation is at 8.5%. Falling purchasing power means Europeans are eating less, not just heating less. Average food consumption fell by 4.6% last year in France, something not seen since records began in 1960, and will likely fuel protests but threaten to bring the country to a standstill. In Spain, Zara owner Inditex SA recently agreed to increase the pay of its store workers by an average of 20%. This will come at a huge cost as governments deal with rising prices while simultaneously subsidizing their population's energy bills. And if recession has so far been averted, it's because states undertook huge spending efforts worth close to $1 trillion to protect households and to facilitate a reversal of dependence on Russian gas. Repeating the feat in 2023 will be a struggle. Meanwhile, major oil-producing countries are cutting supplies of crude. Less oil flowing to refineries should mean higher gasoline prices for drivers and could boost the inflation hitting Europe. That may also help Russia weather Western sanctions. It seems that the energy crisis has just begun, and next winter is where the real challenge lies.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Europe has not made enough progress in locking in long-term contracts for liquefied natural gas LNG as an alternative to Russian pipeline supply, which may prove costly next winter, as a rebound in Chinese demand could sharply tighten the market. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, the EU has not secured enough long-term contracts for liquefied natural gas to replace discontinued pipeline supplies from Russia, and is facing the prospect of higher costs next winter due to rising demand in China. The bloc managed to reduce its dependence on Russian energy last year by ramping up LNG imports to 121 million tons, which represented a 60% increase compared to 2021, according to Reuters. Much of this was bought by the EU on the spot market, where LNG prices are significantly higher than the costs negotiated under long-term contracts. According to the International Energy Agency, LNG prices more than tripled last year, and the bloc spent some $190 billion on supercooled gas. In 2022, the EU accounted for more than a third of the global spot market, compared to just 13% in 2021. Industry analysts have warned that this could jump to over 50% if the bloc fails to secure long-term deals. Morten Fish, senior partner at Morten Fish Consulting, believes the EU should cover around 70 to 75% of its LNG supply through long-term sale and purchase agreements, SPAs. But since the Green lobby in Europe has managed to persuade politicians wrongly that hydrogen to a large extent can replace natural gas as an energy carrier by 2030, Europe has become far too reliant on spot and short-term purchases of LNG, he added. Meanwhile, Asian buyers are at the head of the race for limited global supply, particularly China, which has seen a strong rebound from the pandemic. Victor Tenev, an LNG business consultant at consulting company Reuters, said EU companies would need to act first by signing a series of large-scale long-term SPAs based on the Chinese model to hedge themselves against any ups and downs of the turbulent global LNG market. Felix Booth, head of LNG at Vortexa, explained China's focus on security of supply has allowed the country to continue its support for green energy projects, whereas European buyers are concerned about committing to supply well into the start of their net zero targets. The EU is still a long way from fully substituting Russian pipeline gas supplies, leaving the bloc exposed again to damningly expensive spot market, according to Tenev. Meanwhile, Euronews reported annual energy inflation in the EU reached a record level following Russia-Ukraine crisis. The annual energy inflation rate exceeded 40% in June 2022, and then prices began falling gradually. In February 2023, energy inflation was considerably lower compared to the same period in the previous year. However, many households and businesses still struggle with the cost of energy in Europe. European governments have allocated significant support to households and business to mitigate the impact of larger energy bills in the midst of overall cost of living crises. Winter has almost ended in Europe. Households will soon be relieved of the bulk of their energy bills as their main use of energy is for home heating. 63% of final energy consumption in the residential sector in the EU in 2020. However, energy for other purposes such as lighting, heating water and cooking remains a crucial necessity for Europeans. In February 2023, residential electricity prices, including taxes in the EU, varied from 9.2 euro cents per kilowatt hour in Hungary to 49.2 kilowatt hour in Ireland, according to the Household Energy Price Index, HEPI. These prices reflect the cost in the capital cities of each country rather than the average rate.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's involvement in the South Caucasus region and also the rupee becoming the trading currency between India and Malaysia. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the growing relation between India and Armenia and New Delhi's resistance to the establishment of Zangezur Corridor. And we shall also take a look at rupee coming up as a trading currency between India and Malaysia, thus reducing the monopoly of the dollar.
Since decades, the South Caucasus has played a relatively minor role in India's foreign policy. However, over the past several years, the scenario has changed. The geographical location of the South Caucasus countries being important has provided a viable corridor for India's connectivity with Russia and Europe through Central Asia and Iran. The region also has the potential to meet some of India's requirements of raw material and technology, including oil and gas, minerals, and also gold and uranium.
In the past few years, there has been a gradual interest in the region, and New Delhi's strategy towards the Caucasus countries has seen a change. There have been economic and political developments indicating India's growing interests in the economic and infrastructural potential of the South Caucasus. However, India's interests in the region are not at par with those of other global players. Yet at the same time, the region's importance for New Delhi cannot be ignored owing to its geopolitical location. Amongst the South Caucasus countries, Armenia is relatively the closest partner of India. Armenia is the only country in this region with which India has a treaty relationship. Fresh impetus to political interaction was provided by Prime Minister Modi's meeting with his Armenian counterpart in 2019, which was followed later by Indian External Affairs Minister's visit to Yerevan in 2022. Armenia is also the largest recipient of India's development assistance. On the contrary, there have been no foreign delegation visits between India, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Armenia and Azerbaijan are members of the International North-South Transport Corridor, of which New Delhi is a part. India has also been supporting Yerevan's proposal to include Chabahar Port in INSTC. For now, India's assessment is that bilateral trade with Armenia is bound to benefit once a free trade agreement between India and the Eurasian Economic Union, currently under negotiations, gets concluded.
Azerbaijan has been pushing to establish the Zangezur Corridor project, a proposed transport corridor that would link it to the Nakhchivan Autonomous Region, a western exclave of Azerbaijan, separated from the rest of the country by Armenian territory. The proposed Zangezur Corridor is also part of a larger transportation project connecting Baku to Istanbul in European Turkey. However, India has been opposing the project as the Iran-Armenian border provides New Delhi access to the Persian Gulf and the Black Sea, circumventing the Suez Canal and bypassing Azerbaijan, with which India shares lukewarm ties.
Armenia is interested in deeper cooperation with India as both the countries share similar geopolitical goals. On the other hand, Azerbaijan and Pakistan form an increasingly close partnership. Islamabad does not recognize Armenia officially, thus fostering close relationship with Baku. Yerevan has been in conflict with Baku over Nagorno-Karabakh. This broader geopolitical setting explains Armenia's efforts to build closer military, technological, and generally diplomatic relations with India. In recent years, there have been important breakthrough agreements on defense supplies from India to Armenia. According to foreign policy experts, the common interests of New Delhi and Yerevan could be the reason behind the decision by the Armenian government to grant India a $40 million deal to supply four India-produced weapon-locating radars to Armenia. The Zangezur Corridor has been actively opposed by the Indian government, which sees it as an obstacle to its access to the north. The worry is that if Armenia loses its land connection with Iran, India's ambitious plan for reaching Europe via the INSTC will be imperiled. Maintaining strong ties with Armenia, Iran has been against a project which it thinks could have consequences for Russia and China as well. For India, Iran plays an important role in its connectivity projects to link Central Asia and Europe. In view of New Delhi's alignment with Tehran and Yerevan, the opposition to Zangezur Corridor will almost certainly persist with its current foreign policy.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by senior fellow and head of West Asia and Central Asia Tillotoma Foundation, Ms. Meena Singh Roy from Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Miss. Now, the ties between India and Armenia have been growing in recent years, with the two countries engaging even in an arms trade deal. So the question is New Delhi trying to fill in the Russian vacuum for Yerevan?
Well, you see, if we look at India's relations with the Caucasian countries, and particularly Armenia, they've been growing, as you said. But this is not to replace Russia or any other country. I think India has always built its relations with an individual country based on its own national interest, based on, you know, its foreign policy goals. And that is what is happening when we look at India-Armenia relations. For past few years, you know, you must have noticed that India's relations with Armenia have grown many folds. And particularly the main pillar of its relationship is also the defense cooperation, which we see growing today. And India was the, you know, it recognized, you know, Armenia's independence. And since then, you know, after 1991, and you know, it's the relationship has been growing, but not at the pace which it has grown in past few years. So it also, you know, reflects the geopolitical changes which are happening globally and regionally. So it is not to replace Russia or any other country, but to sort of maintain relations based on its own strengths.
Mrs. Singh Roy, the region also meets India's demands of oil, gas, minerals, and etc. So how do you see the relation between India and the South Caucasus states evolving in the coming years?
Actually, if you look at the region, India's ties with Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, mainly, you know, its ties have grown with Armenia. As far as the oil, gas, and other resources are concerned, you know, Armenia doesn't have the resources, but India has invested in Azerbaijan, the ONGC. But it is not the main source of, you know, India's energy imports. The major, you know, energy demand.